Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Welcome to Conversations. The city of Mogadishu, which is the capital of Somalia, used to be called the Pearl of Africa. Mogadishu was a tranquil, whitewashed port city on the Indian Ocean. Former citizens have fond memories of its cosmopolitan feel and its easygoing lifestyle. But around 20 years ago, the Somalian Civil War came to Mogadishu. Competing warlords fought for control of the streets, and it's been a burnt-out shell ever since. Nigel Brennan is an Australian photojournalist who came to Mogadishu in 2008. 4 days after arriving, Nigel and a Canadian journalist called Amanda Lindhout were abducted and held hostage. Their captors demanded a ransom of $3 million US for the pair of them. But the policy of the Australian government is to not pay ransoms. Nigel Brennan eventually became the longest held living captive in Australian history outside of a prisoner of war situation. Nigel, along with two other members of his family, have recounted this story in a book called The Price of Life. Nigel Brennan, it is lovely to have you here. I'm sure it's good to be here too.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Richard.
So how does a nice boy from Bundaberg end up in Mogadishu anyway?
Look, I guess photojournalism was something I sort of got into later on in my life. Spent 4 years working overseas, and in the later part of that trip, I came back through India and Nepal and bought myself a new camera. And it was actually when I got home, my girlfriend at the time basically said, you know, you've got a fantastic eye in photography, why don't you do something with it? And so I grew up on shows like Four Corners and Foreign Correspondent, which I loved, reading Time magazine. So I sort of picked the journalism side because was sort of, I guess, driven to tell stories and create stories through photography.
I think we need to talk about this, don't we? People, I'm sure, have asked you again and again, what on earth did you go to Mogadishu for? But the nature of journalism is that you have to go to places and see things the rest of us can't see.
Yeah, look, obviously both Amanda and I copped a lot of criticism for being freelancers in an incredibly dangerous country. You know, unfortunately, with the way the media industry is going these days, there's less full-time staff and media organisations expect a lot of their news to come from freelancers. But look, journalists, if they don't go to countries and shine a light into the darkest corners of the earth, then, you know, we all end up burying our heads in the sand.
Images we've seen from, you know, movies like Black Hawk Down, as reliable as that may be, sort of paint a picture of Mogadishu as something like, I don't know, Stalingrad during the Second World War, sort of burnt out hulks of buildings. Was it still like that when you got there?
Yeah, look, I actually got photographs out from the first 3 days, which were on Amanda's computer. And I've got the most beautiful landscape shot of the port area, and it's completely ruined from the 20 years of war that have occurred there. And I've looked at pictures of Somalia in the 50s and 60s, and it was such a beautiful city, and you had Muslim and Christian living side by side, like the beautiful old Catholic church that you can see in photos back in the 60s, and basically one chunk left of it and the rest of it's complete ruins.
It was Amanda that had invited you to go there. How did you get to know Amanda?
Look, I met Amanda in 2006 in Ethiopia. I'd gone over there to do a commission for the International Rescue Committee. Actually met Amanda in the first couple of days that we were there. I was actually married at the time and ended up having an affair with Amanda, which resulted in the end of my marriage. Amanda and I had a short relationship, but sort of in 2007 when she went to Afghanistan, it sort of fizzled out.
But she got in contact with you and invited you to come to Somalia?
I was actually living in Scotland at the time and was tossing up the idea about going to Afghanistan. Had someone who was trying to help me get accreditation with ISAF to get embedded with the American forces, and rang Dad and told him what I was planning to do, and he begged me not to go and said, look, you're either going to get killed or kidnapped, and I really don't want you to go, and terrified. But he said, at the end of the day, it's your life and you've got to do what you want to do. And I actually got in contact with Amanda, and she was in Iraq, and she said, look, you should come to Iraq and come and shoot some stuff with me. looked at it, thought about it, knew it was going to cost me an absolute bomb in money for security, and again thought, you know, it's an incredibly dangerous country, and don't really know whether going in there for 3 weeks I'm going to get what I want, and there's already a bundle of journalists that are already covering the story. And it must have been a couple of weeks after she actually rang me. She was working as a freelancer for France 24, and they'd notified her, I think, and said, look, we have a backlog of your stories from Baghdad that we can't do anything. So she rang and she said, what do you think about a trip to Africa? We can meet in Nairobi, go into Somalia, shoot some stuff.
You arrived in Mogadishu and caught up with Amanda, and you'd been there for 4 days. What was the plan for the day on that fourth day?
I'd actually organised to go out with Abdi Elmi, Amanda's cameraman, and he was working as our sub-fixer. We'd planned to go out with the Ugandan African Union troops and embed with them for a few hours to do some shots on what they're actually doing in Mogadishu, and that ended up falling through. And then later in the morning, we'd planned to travel out to Afgoya, which is about 20 kilometres, I believe, from Mogadishu. And along that road, there's 5 main internally displaced people's camps. And I think those 5 camps house somewhere between 500,000 to 600,000 people in conditions that no electricity, no running water. So horrendous conditions.
Did you set out with security that day? Did you have security in your vehicle?
Look, when we left the hotel, we had 2 security guards. When we actually got to the Burundi African Union base, which is based in the old Mogadishu University, they had to get out of the vehicle because they are classed as government security, and because we were going into a militia-run area, to be seen actually having government security, then we would have been attacked and they would have been killed, and quite possibly us.
So then for the next part of the drive, you pretty much went on without security?
We basically dropped our security, and hindsight's one of those things, I guess. You look back and that's where we're in a lot of trouble, and had to drive a period of 4 or 5 kilometres or something like that until we picked up a new security detail of 3 guys with AK-47s.
Is the fact that your security abandoned you at the city limits a bit sus in any way, or do you just accept that that's par for the course, or would you think they were worded up?
Oh, look, having now had the opportunity to sort of read a lot of information, certainly we were set up by someone. Who that person is, I have no idea, because I guess after we were ambushed, we were taken to a house or a compound where there are actually people inside that compound waiting for us with weapons and stuff.
So this, whatever it was about to happen to you, was something that was being planned.
Look, there's also a suspicion, because there was a National Geographic team there as well, that we may have actually ran into their ambush.
An ambush planned for someone else?
An ambush planned for the National Geographic team.
When did you know something was wrong while you were in this vehicle?
Look, probably when things were really wrong, when we actually pulled up beside that vehicle that I sort of had imagined was going to be the security detail, and at the time was putting my camera back into the bag and looked up and then saw an AK-47 pointed at the glass and right at my door.
What happened then, Nigel?
I don't know. Brain sort of shut down, I guess. Doors ripped open. All of us were dragged from the vehicle. Amanda and the guys on the left-hand side of the car were brought round to our side and pushed down onto the ground face first. We weren't there for that long. We were then ripped up, all 5 of us thrown into the back seat of the car, along with one of the hijackers or kidnappers. 2 of them jumped in the front of the vehicle, 2 in the back of the Land Cruiser, like closed-in Land Cruiser. And we basically were then taken very quickly off the main road across country for a period of time, you know, it was something like 15, 20 minutes.
Tell me about the attitude of the gunmen that were in the vehicle with you. Were they young and jumpy, or were they sort of better trained and more assured?
No, incredibly jumpy. The guys who were actually sitting behind us had their guns pointed at the back of our heads, like not touching but fairly close. And Amanda kept sort of saying, can you please tell them not to point the weapons at our heads? And Amanda was trying to ask Abdi what was going on at one point. And they barked at us, you know, no talking, be silent.
Where did they take you?
Look, we travelled for about 15 minutes. Amanda was then ripped out of the car, thrown into the vehicle in front, the Suzuki that we pulled up to. We must have travelled for another 10, 15 minutes or something. I was terrified when she was split from me and really concerned, you know, her being a female and what they were going to do with her. Thankfully, about 15 minutes later, they pulled me from the car and put me in with her, and that's when we were first introduced to Ahmed, who was the guy that I believe was the leader of the whole gang. So we were eventually taken to a house. It was just a three-roomed building in a compounded, with a compound wall probably 10 metres high. Put into a room, and then I think after a few hours, these guys who were supposedly the commanders came in and accused us of being spies and working for the Ethiopian forces.
So how did they come to realise you weren't spies?
We sort of laughed. Not laughed, but we thought it was a bit of a joke, I guess. And said to them, look, we're both freelance photojournalists. If you do a simple search on Google on both of our names, it will come up and you'll be able to clearly see that, you know, the reason we're here is as journalists, not working for anyone.
Nigel Brennan is my guest. He was kidnapped in Somalia in 2008 with his companion Amanda Lindhout, and they were held captive for 462 days. So once they were convinced you weren't spies, what did they tell you then? What did they told you they were going to hold you for ransom?
Yeah, look, it was Adam, or Adan, as he's sort of known in the book, told us that they had taken the decision to hold us for ransom because both the Canadian government and the Australian government were at war against Islam, and because both of our countries had troops in Afghanistan, Iraq and Pakistan.
That doesn't make sense in a way, though, does it? They're two different things. Are they doing it for political principle or for the money?
Looking back at the whole thing now, it was all about money, basically. For them, saying it was a political kidnapping was, a smokescreen.
Nigel, I can only imagine in moments like this, you're forestalling panic and you're deeply aware that a wrong word could mean instant death for you and your companion. Can you just talk about that thought process of how one manages their way through a situation like that?
Look, it was strange. Like, now that I've had the ability to sort of sit back and have 19 months and do psychology and talk to psychologists that deal with hostage situations, and one of the things they say is to remain very grey, not to talk too much, obviously not to backchat, not to try and anger your captives. Try and show them straight away that you're a human being and humanise yourself.
Did you know that at the time?
Look, there was stuff that I was doing through the 15 months that I didn't even realise that were basically survival skills, like disassociation from emotion.
Did you get a sense from these men that they'd done this before, that they had some experience in seizing Westerners and holding them hostage for ransom?
No, look, I think a lot of the guys had probably never met or seen a white person before.
So they were making it up as they went along?
Yeah, basically.
Where were you kept initially?
So, look, we were kept, I'm pretty sure it was in 11 different houses. We were moved 13 times over those 15 months. For the first 2 months, was kept in the same room with Amanda, which for me was actually really comforting. Because she was a female, I didn't want her to be by herself, but also to have that companionship. For the first 3 weeks, I went into a complete tailspin and depression and anger and guilt and shame. And there's so many emotions that were mixed in there. And I'd really gone introverted, had sort of withdrawn from Amanda. And it was actually after we moved, one time she pulled me up and she basically said, mate, you've got to pull yourself together. We only have each other. We have to be more positive. I need you to start conversing with me, and we need to start working together. And it was great. It was a hard pill for me to swallow at the time, but 2 days later I was like, my God, she's so completely right. Like, if I'm negative, then there is going to be a negative outcome.
Reading your book about the way you're talking about your captors, it seems like it's kind of a typical group, if you like, for that kind of thing. There's a whole bunch of camp followers and one or two psychopaths in the mix. And there was one called Ali. And in that first period, he said that your family had 24 hours to come up with the ransom. He taunted you with that too, didn't he?
Yeah.
And Amanda.
Look, when they came in and said, you know, we've decided to hold you for ransom, and we explained that our governments wouldn't pay, and because both Australia and the Canadian government have signed a treaty which doesn't allow them to pay ransom for their citizens. And
there's good reasons for that, aren't there?
Yes. Absolutely fantastic reasons for that. If the government pays for one, then they have to pay for all. And there's so many Australians out of the country at one particular day. I think it's a million people per day are outside of our shores.
It just increases the likelihood that more will be kidnapped if they know they can get a ransom.
Yeah, of course.
How did Ali taunt you, though?
So they basically said, you know, what do you think is a fair price? And they came back and said, look, they didn't actually tell us the figure straight off. And he was walking in and saying, you know, you have 24 hours for your family to pay, otherwise we're going to kill you. And this is what they'd said to us. If we don't get money in 24 hours, we're going to kill you. So he would then come in every hour or 2 hours and continue to say this, you know. 19 hours. How do you feel? 50-50? Are you ready to die? because we're going to kill you. If we don't get money for you in 19 hours, we're going to kill you.
Was he enjoying himself while he was saying that?
I think, yeah, for sure, he was getting some sadistic pleasure by seeing us absolutely terrified.
Now, Nigel, this brings your family into the equation now. Did they even know you were in Somalia?
No. I think probably about three people knew I was going to Somalia.
How did your family then find out that you'd been kidnapped?
Obviously didn't find this out
until
I'd come home and having read Kel's part. But Kel was contacted by Glenda Quick, who was a journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald, asking if she could confirm the fact that her brother had been kidnapped in Somalia along with Amanda Lindhout. Kel then obviously had to make that phone call to my mum and dad to say this has happened, and mum wouldn't believe it at the first, and she said, no, he's in Kenya. And I think Kel said, well, Somalia's right next door to Kenya. You should probably get a map and have a look.
When did you first get your first contact from an Australian official while being held captive?
I think the first phone call was from the Australian Federal Police, actually. It was a gentleman down in South Africa.
What did he tell you, Nigel?
Look, I can't recall.
Wanted to ask you questions more than...
Look, I think he just wanted to reassure us that the government knew what was going on and that they were working, you know, they'd been in contact with our family and trying to work with the family and trying to get things rolling.
So as time goes by, as you're being held there, you got into conversation with your guards. They wanted to ask you about Islam. Tell me how that unfolded and your conversion to Islam, if I may put it that way.
Look, right at the start, they asked us whether we were religious at all, and both of us said that we both followed Christianity, which was a bit of a firthy from me. And it was actually Ahmed, the head guy, that said to us, you know, that Islam was the best religion and the best possible thing we could do was to become Muslim. He sort of added with that the fact that if we became Muslim, that they couldn't kill us, and if we didn't become Muslim, they would take the money from our families or from the government and possibly kill us. So sort of hearing that, Amanda and I made a request for English Qurans, and they were a bit suspicious on why we wanted that. I sort of explained that to Ali, that I had very little knowledge in regards to Islam. I said that, look, I want to understand your religion better and I want to understand your culture better. A few days later, turned up with two English Qurans. Which was great because I threw myself into that in the first week trying to read it. Amanda and I had discussed the possibility of conversion, I guess, as a way of trying to save our bacon.
So you didn't convert in your hearts, but you felt you had to make a good show of it.
I was actually probably halfway through reading the Quran, and she actually came back from outside at one point and said to me, I've told them that we're converting to Islam at 11 o'clock. And I was a bit taken aback. I was just like, well, hang on, this is a massive decision that we're going to make, and if we're going to do this, then we have to make sure that we can back it up. And she said, well, I've told them, and we can't really go back on it now.
Meanwhile, back in Australia, your parents had been told of the ransomers' demand, which was $3 million US for the both of you. Did your parents have anything like that kind of money?
Look, Mum and Dad had a superannuation fund. They'd just retired from a farm, but trying to get $3 million together in that sort of time period was impossible. I don't think they would be able to get $3 million together even now.
Not many people can, no. I mean, it's common practice, isn't it, with such kidnappings, for kidnappers to start with an outrageous ambit claim, because the amount they want is all of it, really, isn't it? All of the money that anyone can possibly get their hands on, rather than any sort of set dollar figure. And the way they determine that is to make an outrageous ambit claim and allow themselves to be negotiated down.
Yeah, look, I guess ransoming and kidnapping is all about trying to squeeze every single last penny out of the family. You know, unfortunately, Amanda and I were a commodity to the kidnappers, and the only buyers were our families.
Tell me about your first conversation with your sister, Nikki.
Look, it was a fantastic phone call in some respects, and actually really sad in others, just to hear Nick's voice and to know that my family now knew that I was actually alive, because Amanda had had a number of phone calls and I hadn't been granted that. And I think it was the day after we had actually converted, so it was about day 11. At that stage, was going through all that emotion of guilt and shame and anger, like at myself, at Amanda, at the kidnappers, for what, you know, what had happened to my life and what I was actually doing to my family. You know, turned their life upside down.
What was the Australian Federal Police and Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade telling your family? Were they giving you a similar message, or the same message? Was DFAT telling you one thing and the federal police telling you the same thing, or were they conflicting?
Look, I think DFAT were basically saying to my family that they can't pay a ransom and they won't facilitate a ransom. The Australian Federal Police, on the other hand, were saying to my family that if you want them back, you're going to have to pay a ransom and you're going to have to liquidate assets to pay that ransom.
Was DFAT saying the Australian government couldn't pay a ransom? Did they give you that your parents that message that your parents would have to come up with the money?
No, I think they were basically saying to my family, you can't pay a ransom.
It shouldn't be privately raised either.
When the money was privately raised, the Australian government were saying, we can't facilitate that payment. Like, it wasn't government money that was being used, it was my family's money and Dick Smith's money, but they were saying, we can't actually facilitate that.
You were asked to appear in several videos while you were in captivity. Were you given a script?
We did the two videos. The first one was a propaganda video, basically after we had converted, why we had become Muslim, what we would say to people that saw Islam as an extremist religion. So it was just a propaganda piece that they said that they were going to put up on YouTube. The second video was the one that was the scary one, I guess, which was our ransom video. So walked out of our room into the courtyard to see those guys all kitted up with guns and headscarves. It was all scripted. They told us what they wanted us to say, and it was the same with all of the phone calls. Were all scripted. They would make us write what they wanted us to say to our families or to the government.
Were you fed properly?
At the start, we were both scared about getting sick, so I actually lived on tuna, like a tin of tuna in the morning, a tin of tuna in the evening for 125 days.
Can you have tuna now?
It's funny, one of my good friends, Liz Wilson, mistakenly gave me a tuna sandwich recently, and she knows my story quite well, and she was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And it's like, no, it's okay if it's in a sandwich. But look, at the start we were given clean water, they gave us medicine when we were sick. Basically, after we were separated, our conditions started to deteriorate from that point on.
How did your family manage to get a care package to you?
I have no idea how that was facilitated. I'm guessing by the embassies in Nairobi from both Canada and America. They put a list of stuff together, and I've seen the list. It was about 3 foolscap pages. I think we probably got maybe half a foolscap page of that stuff. But look, there was some great stuff in there for me. Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom, which was an amazing book to have in captivity. 1,000 Splendid Sons, some of Ernest Hemingway books, crosswords, Sudoku puzzles, medicine, paper, pencil, eraser, sharpeners. At the same time as getting it, like, actually burst into tears, and to think that my family had touched some of this stuff and was also quite upset by how much stuff there was. And it was like, oh my God, how long am I actually going to be here for? Like, there seems to be so much stuff here.
You made an escape. How did you do it? How did you get out?
Everyone's probably seen the movie Shawshank Redemption. It was a slow process. We were taken with 3 Somalian guys that were working for us. They disappeared out of the house around the 5-month mark. And when they actually disappeared, we were told that they had been released. And Amanda and I were incredibly positive about that. And we'd been split at this stage, and we'd been managing to communicate without them knowing.
How? With letters?
We started off with notes in the bathroom. We would have knock codes on the wall to tell each other that we'd left a message, and we'd knock a code to tell the other person that we'd read it and destroyed it. We ended up whispering, because we had a window on the exterior wall of the house that was about 5 or 6 metres apart. And the next house was very close, so there was a small alleyway and the roofs crossed over, so the acoustics was fantastic and we could talk very softly and actually hear each other. So when the 3 Somalians had disappeared, and one of the younger guys, one of the brutal guys, Abdullah, taunted us and said that they had been given to Al-Shabaab and beheaded, and we thought, well, if they're Muslim and we're Muslim, we're going to end up in the same sort of state. And Amanda had already had one fake assassination done on her, and she was terrified by that stage and wanted to get out. And
well, she'd been taken and had a gun put to her head.
Taken out in the middle of the night, had a gun put to her head, and they told her that they were going to kill her because her family had no money. So she begged for life and then was put on the phone to her mother and said, they're saying, we have 7 days. If you don't get the money to them by then, they're going to kill me. So we started looking for escape plans. Amanda's plan was to go up over an exterior wall, which means we both would have had to have been in the courtyard. Daylight job, really dodgy. We had a bathroom that basically only Amanda and I shared at the back of the house, which is next to my room. looked at that, quite fortified with Rio bars running across, and having building knowledge, thought side walls would have been Caulfield and would have been impossible to move the bars. And I climbed up there one day because it was 6 foot off the ground, and actually one of the bars slipped across. And I thought, bingo, here we go, if this could be a winner here. So I actually slid two of the bars out, managed to get them out of the wall, went back and said to Amanda, look, I think we've got a way through the bathroom. And she looked at it and said, how long do you think it's going to take to remove the bricks? We'd put in a plan because Amanda wasn't strong enough to actually pull herself up onto the window ledge to chip away at the mortar. She kept a watch while I snuck out of my room and slowly chipped away with a dull pair of scissors and the nail file off the nail clippers.
Chipping away at the cement around the brick.
Yeah, they were like Besser block sized ladder style bricks, 2 inches thick. The mortar wasn't mortar completely all around; it was just dabbed in places. So slowly dug it away. It took, I don't know, probably 2.5 days to finally then to be able to move the bricks out. And I can remember sitting up on the ledge and had the bars out and finally took all the bricks out and actually stuck my head outside the other side of the house and looked down the alleyway and was just like, yes, you beauty, this is going to be so embarrassing to them. And it was the two-fingered salute to our captors.
This is Conversation with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Nigel Brennan is my guest. Nigel was kidnapped in Somalia in 2008, along with a fellow journalist, Amanda Lindhout, and they were held captive for 462 days. Nigel's book, written with members of his family, is called The Price of Life, A True Story of Kidnap and Ransom. So, Nigel, you chipped away at the mortar around these bricks, and you were ready to make your escape. How did you break out?
So I put everything back in place and said to Amanda, right, we're set. We had a plan of going at night. We knew we were somewhere close to the airport, knew that that was controlled by African Union troops, and if we could get there, we would be safe. It was on the Wednesday night, the 20th. Amanda went to the bathroom. I followed her, snuck behind her, got all the bricks out, got the two bars out, got Amanda up into the window, watched her for 4 or 5 minutes. It seemed like an eternity. Heart pounding in my chest and wanting to just push her through the window, and she turned around, she said, I can't fit. And just that fear, like the dread from the bottom of your belly. And I just said, right, get down, go back to your room. So I followed her back to her room and then got into my room and just wanted to scream, absolutely scream. And then had to knock on the door and get one of the guards to come down and then feigned that I had a stomach upset so that I could go back into the bathroom and actually put the jigsaw puzzle back together so there wasn't a massive gaping hole in the window. Finally got that done and walked back into the room and just collapsed. I hadn't slept for, I don't know, 48 hours, just the adrenaline and the fear and the excitement of actually escaping. Next morning, went in without Amanda even knowing and removed another Rio bars to give us enough room to get through. And then changed the plan, and thinking about it, when Amanda was taken out on her assassination attempt when she was driving back, they'd shown her all the criminal gangs that roam the streets at night. So I was quite concerned about, you know, we were going to get out, but we were going to get shot straight away. So I said to her, you know, if I was in a Western country and I was in trouble, the first place I would go to is a house of worship, because there would be good people there and they'll take care of us. And I said, look, and we're Muslim. So the fact that we're Muslim, if we run to a mosque, people will try and protect us. So we changed the plan and instead of going at night time, went right on noonday prayer, because we knew that the mosque would be filled with people. Again, went in, did the whole process. Amanda actually got out, was trying to be quiet, and then I actually got up onto the window ledge and got one leg out and, you know, almost crushed the ghoulies in the process. And then couldn't fit and then was panicking and must have been making a hell of a noise. And finally I had to go through head first and grabbed onto the gutter of the roof next door, which was plastic, and it nearly snapped and I nearly fell from the window. Finally get out, jump down, hit the ground, and just filled with adrenaline, absolute adrenaline, excitement, and just that sense of freedom and the fact that we'd taken matters into our own hands and we'd got out and we were going to show those people how stupid they were. And a man turned around to me and said, we've already been spotted by someone. And then that fear and dread just flooding straight back in, pulled our shoes in, and we just ran. Like I've said to friends, you know, it was like an out-of-body experience. I was watching myself pound down this street and just screaming, like, you know, please help us, please help us, please help, because I'd learnt some Somalian from one of the young guys, so please help, please help. Eventually made our way to the mosque, got in there, and then was basically saying to everyone, one Muslim, which is in Somali is I am Muslim, we are Muslim. Began reciting the Quran, the profession of faith, so all of the stuff that I had been learning over the last 5 months in regards to Islam. These people actually tried to help us, and, you know, first complete surprise, and they actually grabbed, because by this stage, like, our captors were literally 30 seconds behind us. As we actually climbed the steps of the mosque, there was a shot fired over our head, a warning shot. So, you know, the place just erupts in pandemonium, and Amanda and I are there, and we're, you know, hysterical, hearts in your mouth. I can remember at the time just having the pasties, couldn't, no saliva whatsoever in my mouth and trying to talk. And there was a couple of guys there that actually spoke English and pulled us into a circle and were trying to help us and asked us who we were and what had happened. And we were eventually put into the pulpit and told that an imam was on his way to interview us. And if we were in fact Muslim, then we would be safe and they would protect us. Unfortunately, the imam didn't get there in time, and we were surrounded by what seemed like 1,000 people. It was probably 100, and they all, civilians, just ran in the opposite direction from us. And can remember looking at the side doors, which were all open, and just watching these masked gunmen running with AK-47s. Never seen any of them before. There were obviously other groups, other criminal gangs, could have been Al-Shabaab, and just thought, this is going to end in an absolute bloodbath. Our head guys rock up, and we're not happy campers. Grab both of us, trying to pull us out. I actually sort of just put myself into reverse, was trying to back myself into a corner, and can remember watching, seeing Amanda being dragged out by hair, arm, whatever they could grab her by, and was sort of concentrating on where I was trying to do, and look back, couldn't see Amanda, and probably 5-10 seconds later just heard a single gunshot ring out, and just absolutely, you know, just thought, you know, they've just shot her. And the head guys then come back for me, and Ahmed basically got his pistol and whipped it across the back of my head and neck, and I just went into fetal position, just getting punched and kicked, and they've basically grabbed me by the legs and dragged me through the mosque out onto the courtyard, you know, dragging me some on my elbows, just ripping bits of meat off my elbows. They pick me up, put me above their heads, six of them, and again, an out-of-body experience, and was incredibly calm. And I can remember thinking, like, I just wish I could tell Mum and Dad that I love them and that I'm so sorry for the pain that I've caused them. And thought, right, I'm actually about to die. I'm just about to take a bullet to the back of the head and there's nothing I can do about it, and was incredibly calm. And then to be walked through the gates of the mosque and seeing Amanda in the back of the car still kicking the captors trying to get out was just amazing. And, you know, they toss me in the back next to her and they all jump in beside us, and can remember grabbing Amanda's hand and looking at her, and her face had swollen up where she'd obviously taken a pretty good punch to the head. And she said, you know, I'm so sorry for making you escape. And I said, well, no, don't be sorry. And that was really, really intense. And we both actually said, we were really concerned that they were then just going to drive us out to the bush and put a bullet into our heads and just leave us in a ditch somewhere. And we're driving along, both saying, you know, look, if I die and you survive, then just tell Mum and Dad that I love them and I'm sorry and blah, blah, blah. And eventually get taken to an unknown house and interrogated for several hours. And that's when they brought the leg shackles. And we were shackled then for the remaining time that we were actually, until we were actually released.
You beaten after that?
So bizarre. That night we were actually moved back to a house, and I didn't actually know where we were until the next morning. And they'd actually taken us back to the house that we'd escaped from. And I was just like, these guys are obviously really, really dumb or retarded. Like, it was just like, how could have they brought us back here? Like, everyone's going to know that we're in this house. And then hear Amanda screaming in her room. And I can remember I had my belt on, and I actually took it off and tried to hide it because I was terrified that they were going to use that to beat me. Young Abdullah actually came into my room, took my sarong and put a complete head blindfold on me, was then strip searched, went through all the seams of my clothes. So I'm basically standing there completely naked. Obviously couldn't take the jeans off my legs because I had shackles on, and I could hear voices around me, you know, four or five, don't know who was there, and basically took quite a couple of nasty blows to the solar plexus and slaps to the head, and terrified, trying to protect myself, and they kept pulling my arms down, and then, you know, the king hit of all, a knee to the balls, and have gone down onto the ground, and they pushed me face down onto the tiles, and then feel what I'm pretty sure it was an AK-47, like a piece of steel to the back of my head, and cocked, and just thinking, you know, trying to make myself believe that they weren't going to kill me. Like, if they were going to kill us, they would have done it yesterday. Why would they do it now? And then they just ransacked my room and took any personal effects, diaries, pencils, paper. The only thing that they left me with, which I was so grateful for, because if they had have taken it away, it would have actually been so destructive to me, and that was Nelson Mandela's book.
You're hearing the story of Australian photojournalist Nigel Brennan, who was kidnapped and held for ransom in Somalia along with a fellow journalist, Amanda Linhout, in 2008. They spent more than a year in captivity. He's written his story with other members of his family. It's called The Price of Life, A True Story of Kidnap and Ransom. Meanwhile, back in Australia, all negotiations are still going on, this torturous process of raising money and negotiating with hostages. In the end, could the Australian government give your family any help at all? And how did the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, how did their attitude strike your family members when it came to this?
Look, I think what my family got really upset with, especially with DFAT, was the lack of information. They were being told that they didn't have security clearance or for the intelligence that was coming through. And because my brother or brothers live away from Moore Park, they would have family meetings, and that information was then emailed to them so that the rest of my family knew what was going on. And DFAT said, well, you've got to stop that. You can't be sending emails across the open source, and because it's not safe, and you can't use mobile phones. And there was a suggestion basically that that my mother would ring my brother on a public telephone. And Mum said, well, that's great. He lives 15 kilometres from town. What he's meant to drive there and back. So there was outrageous sort of stuff like that was going on that really, I think, just drove my family insane. And
sounds like they're obsessed with process rather than outcomes.
I guess it's one of those things that the wheels of government always move incredibly slowly. And talking to friends who work in the army and stuff like that, and they said basically your situation was something that no one wanted that to blow up in their face, because when you're in government, it's about the next job that you can get. It's moving up the ladder. And when the music stopped, no one wanted that hot potato to land in their lap. You know, the fact that Stephen Smith took 4 months to reply to a letter from my family was outrageous. The fact that Kevin Rudd, when he was Prime Minister, didn't even know who I was when my mother confronted him in Bundaberg. And when Mum actually did get a sit-down interview with him, Mum said, what are you going to do about my son in Somalia? And he said, if that's your attitude and if that's the way you're going to talk to me, this conversation's over and this meeting's done. That wasn't recorded, but that's basically what was said.
How was the money found? How was an amount found? Because in the end, it wasn't $3 million that was paid, but was the money found?
Look, I was incredibly lucky, and my family, I think, were incredibly lucky. My family were in a much better financial situation than Amanda's family. I had three aunts who were incredibly generous. I think between those three aunts, they put in close to $400,000. My family put in, I think it was $190,000. There was fundraisers that my brother Ham had a huge amount to do with. They raised $90,000.
How was Dick Smith able to help?
The problem at the end was the Australians had money and the Canadians had their money. The Canadian government said to the Lindhouts, paying ransom is illegal and you will go to jail. So they said, if you send that money to Australia, then you will be basically paying a ransom. So the Canadian family actually wouldn't release their money to Australia so that it could be sent. So it was my family that it was actually my brother Ham who first got in contact with Bob Brown. Like, Bob Brown put in $100,000 of his own money. He took out a personal loan, I believe. Bob actually got in contact with Dick Smith and said, we have to help this family.
$100,000 of his own money?
Yes. Yeah. Kel and my family rang Dick and said, look, we have the money in Canada, but we can't get it here. Can you back us and we can pay that money back once the ransom's paid? So, look, that's one of the things that I think Dick was very contentious about. Was it was Australia that paid the ransom for both of us. And Dick was really angry with, I think, a lot of wealthy people in Canada that they let the Australians take the rap. Like, and unfortunately for Kel, because Kel signed that document to release that money to pay the ransom, she's the one that now faces a possible 25 years to life for giving money if it was...
For paying a ransom, essentially.
Well, yeah. They were told by the Australian government that they would be breaking for international laws, and one of those laws held a 25-year to life sentence.
Has she been charged? Is there any expectation she'll be charged?
Look, we've been told by the Australian government that they don't intend to follow anything up. They said whether America or other countries do follow that up, then that's unfortunate for you.
How did you become aware you were going to be released?
There were two attempts. The first attempt, I actually got a phone call from Nick and she said, mate, I'm in Nairobi. If everything goes to plan, within the next 24 hours, you'll be here as well. And it was a 19-second phone call or something like that, and could not but help get extremely excited. And then 3 hours later for one of the head guys to come in and say your family's broken their promise, they haven't called us, so the deal's off. A week went past, 10 days went past. We were actually moved back to Mogadishu, which was a great sign because it was like, well, we're very close to an international airport. Got a phone call shortly after, probably 2 weeks after Nick's phone call. It was actually from one of the extraction team who was actually in Mogadishu trying to make a deal. At that stage, didn't allow myself to get excited. And then I think, another 4 or 5 days went past and didn't actually realise, because our kidnappers had actually been threatening us with on-selling us to a group like Al-Shabaab. So the day we were released, it was about 4:30 in the afternoon, and I can remember seeing Amanda being marched out of a room and just... Like I said, that whole time, the fear that you are consumed by, and it was just like, oh my God, what are they doing? Are they going to rape her? Are they about to separate us and sell her to someone else? Are they about, are we about to be killed? So they then came in, grabbed me and took me into the next room and said, right, strip all your clothing and put, they had brand new clothing on, and trying to ask them what was going on there, like, stop talking. Told me to change into jeans. I said, well, that'd be good if I didn't have chains around my ankles, guys. And then they went and found keys, and because we'd been wearing them for so long, the locks had actually rusted. So they then had to find a hacksaw, and it took them about 30 minutes, 45 minutes to finally chop the locks off, and was then bundled into the car. We actually hooked up with a few other cars in convoy, and it was Ahmed. We'd made 5 promises to him earlier on in regards to possibly a way for us to be released. And we'd stopped sort of in the middle of nowhere, and he came to the car and we said, we had an agreement where you've promised certain things. Do you intend to keep those promises? And I looked him straight in the eye and lied to him straight in the face and said, yeah, of course I have. We're brothers. Said the same thing to Amanda, and, a little bit hopeful and that maybe we were going somewhere, and we go back in convoy and drive for another 25 minutes. And by this time it's pitch dark. We finally come to a stop, taken from our car, put into the car in the front, and there's 2 guys that are sitting there, never seen before, and quite panicky that we've never seen these guys before. They're in civilian clothing, and he asks us our name, which he then picks up a phone, and we're sitting there, and suddenly the door on my side opens up, and one of the kidnappers had thrown my Quran in on my lap, which I'd begged them for, because I just wanted something to hang on to, and, if we were going to another group, I wanted to have, their whole list of books, I guess I thought would protect me somehow. We tear off and hit a main intersection, hang left, and we're flying down the road, and then all of a sudden we hit this, this car comes out of nowhere and blocks the road, and we come to a screaming halt, and then all of a sudden we're surrounded by what seemed like 50 civilian guys with AK-47. The car that's pulled it, you know, blocked our way, has got a massive machine gun anchored to the back of it. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is Al-Shabaab. We've just been ambushed by Al-Shabaab. And another car pulls up beside of us. So we're ripped from that car, thrown into a four-wheel drive beside us, and then sort of taken in convoy. And both Amanda and I, completely hysterical, and the guy beside us telling us to calm down, and he said, you're safe, and I sort of said, you know, I can't remember whether I said it or thought it, but it was like, well, if we're safe, where are the white people? I want to see some white people. And he said, they're at the airport, the extraction team's at the airport. And it wasn't really until he actually took his phone and rang Amanda's mother and put her onto the phone, and they were talking, that I guess it sort of started to allow myself to believe that we're actually going to be safe.
How was your feeling then upon being released? Was it just exhaustion or silly giddy joy?
At one point disbelief, at the other giddy joy, like to actually finally be able to sit next to Amanda and touch her and look at her. It was like I was, a nervous teenager. Who'd never touched a girl before. And, you know, it was quite ironic because we ended up having to stay at the Sahafi Hotel overnight, and we locked ourselves into a hotel room. So here we were again, locked in a room.
In Nairobi?
No, this is in Mogadishu. So this is we were released in the evening, and then the next day we flew out and, you know, managed to talk to my sister, which I was so excited about. And then Nick said, don't want to freak you out, but a couple of French guys were kidnapped from that hotel 6 months ago, and I went into meltdown. And then the world media, you know, Amanda and I had absolutely no concept of how big the stories was going to be back in our countries. And then, you know, the next morning when the extraction team arrived, and one of the guys was a Kiwi, and he's such a lovely guy, and met me and gave me a big hug and said, mate, I've got a can of Foster's for you in the plane, which I thought was great. Next thing he says to me is, mate, not a good year in sport. You lost the Bundesliga.
Oh.
You lost the Ashes, and I think you even lost the netball. So, and it was hilarious.
There's a time and a place.
Oh, I loved it. It was the humour that I needed. Look, getting on that plane and actually taking off was euphoric, absolute euphoric. I have such this glow and happiness inside and just tears pouring down my face, and one of the other guys in the extraction team just laughing at us. I think he was so happy for us. And you know, he actually took that photo of me with the big bushy beard with the grin on my face.
So now you're back in Australia, and you're looking extremely well and fit. Are you as well and fit as you look?
I am. Look, I've been doing some great work with my doctor and with my psychologist. And look, it's funny, a lot of my friends when I got home said, you seem quite normal. And I said, well, how am I meant to act? And I think my family were really concerned that I was going to be a complete
post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, yeah. I guess for me, I have to take responsibility for my actions. I was the one that decided to go to Somalia. No one made me go. That was my decision. Coming home was like, well, look, I've already lost 15 months of my life. What's the point of me crawling up into a ball and having self-pity? That helps no one. Both family and friends have been so grounding.
In Brisbane, you were contacted by the Somali community of Brisbane and
yep.
Invited to a function. Tell me how that unfolded.
I was contacted by a gentleman by the name of Hussein Ahmed, who I think is the president of the Somalian Brisbane community. He said that they would love to have a gathering for me to welcome me home. And when he first mentioned it, was incredibly anxious about the whole thing. And
why?
I think just walking into a room with Somalian people was quite a terrifying thing. I guess my own insecurities, because those people hadn't done anything to me at all.
Did you take some people along for moral support?
I took Mum and Dad along, and I also took a good friend, Kev Kariri, who works in the Queensland Police Force. He was actually one of the negotiators that was involved very first up.
And what happened when you walked into that function room?
Probably about 150 people that were there, and these people just rushed towards me and embraced me and shook my hand and said, you know, we're so thankful that you went to try and tell the story of Somalia, and we apologise for what our countrymen did to you, and they embarrass us and they embarrass our country. those people in that hall that night had prepared food and put on traditional dance, and it was amazing. Like, because I guess when I it was one of those sad things flying out of Somalia was, you know, I'm sitting there looking out the plane window and we flew down the coastline and it's incredibly beautiful, beautiful surf beaches, a country that I really didn't get a chance to see other than four walls most of the time. To then come home and sort of be immersed in these people and sort of get to know their culture, and, you know, even though it was only a 3-4 hour thing, but to have people come up and shake my hand and want their photo taken with me was pretty bizarre. And then to hear their stories, one woman's in particular, you know, just made me realise that my ordeal was, you know, nothing compared to what a lot of people in third world countries go through.
Nigel, just finally, how's Amanda, your cellmate and your fellow captive? Are you in contact with her, and how's she doing? How's she recovering?
Look, still keeping contact with Amanda. She's actually set up a foundation to educate Somalian women. Both of us are incredibly busy, so...
You're the only witnesses to each other's ordeal. You're the only people who really know what she went
through. Well, it's bizarre. Like, it's such a shared experience. I guess in one respect, we've had two very different journeys as well. Because we were separated for 13 months, what she went through, I don't really have a clear picture of exactly what happened to her.
And how are you different now, do you think? And have you even had enough time to assess that?
I think I've had enough time.
I'm sure everyone wants you to be over it now and wants you to have processed it all, but it's going to take a lot longer than that, isn't it?
Look, my psychologist said it'll probably take 3 years until I actually get to a point where I can start, I guess, putting it into little boxes in the back of my memory. But look, certainly have an amazing appreciation of my family and what they did for me to save my life. I guess have a real appreciation for what they've done, and the same goes with my friends. And, you know, communities like Bundaberg, Mora and Gundawindi, which is, you know, communities where we've come from and where we now live, that were behind my family. But look, how have I changed? Have a much more positive outlook on life.
Really?
Yeah.
After all that?
Like I was saying at the start, was incredibly negative. And I guess my ethos now is, and it's something that my brother believes in too, is positive thoughts, positive outcomes.
I love the fact you escaped. I mean, you were caught. But I love the fact you escaped.
Well, it was funny because the escape, actually, I kept a diary after we escaped, a hidden diary, but my dates were out by about 5 or 6 days, and I actually thought the day we were escaping was Australia Day. That was my two-fingered salute to them, saying, this is our day and I'm getting out of here.
A virtual Australia Day. Gee, it's been great to hear your story, Nigel. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Richard, pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Nigel Brennan's book that he's co-written with Nicole Bonney and Kelly Brennan, members of his family, is called The Price of Life, A True Story of Kidnap and Ransom.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.